Chapter 15. Mr. Tulliver shows his weaker side. Suppose Sister Gleck should call her money in. It'd be very awkward for you to have to raise £500 now, said Mrs. Tulliver to her husband that evening, as she took a plaintive review of the day. Mrs. Tulliver had lived 13 years with her husband, yet she retained in all the freshness of her early married life a facility of saying things which drove him in the opposite direction to the one she desired. Some minds are wonderful for keeping their bloom in this way, as a patriarchal goldfish apparently retains to the last its youthful illusion that it can swim in a straight line beyond the encircling glass. Mrs. Tulliver was an amiable fish of this kind, and after running her head against the same resisting medium for 13 years would go at it again today with undulled alacrity. This observation of hers tended directly to convince Mr. Tulliver that it would not be at all awkward for him to raise £500, and when Mrs. Tulliver became rather pressing, to know how he would raise it without mortgaging the mill, and the house which he had said he never would mortgage, since nowadays people were none so ready to lend money without security, Mr. Tulliver, getting warm, declared that Mrs. Glegg might do as she liked about calling in her money, he should pay it in whether or not. He was not going to be beholden to his wife's sisters. When a man had married into a family where there was a whole litter of women, he might have plenty to put up with if he chose. But Mr. Tulliver did not choose. Mrs. Tulliver cried a little in a trickling, quiet way as she put on her nightcap, but presently sank into a comfortable sleep, lulled by the thought that she would talk everything over with her sister Pullet tomorrow, when she was to take the children to Garum Firs to tea. Not that she looked forward to any distinct issue from that talk, but it seemed impossible that past events should be so obstinate as to remain unmodified when they were complained against. Her husband lay awake rather longer, for he too was thinking of a visit he would pay on the morrow, and his ideas on the subject were not of so vague and soothing a kind as those of his amiable partner. Mr. Tulliver, when under the influence of a strong feeling, had a promptitude in action that may seem inconsistent with that painful sense of the complicated, puzzling nature of human affairs under which his more dispassionate deliberations were conducted. But it is really not improbable that there was a direct relation between these apparently contradictory phenomena, since I have observed that for getting a strong impression that a skein is tangled, there is nothing like snatching hastily at a single thread. It was owing to this promptitude that Mr. Tulliver was on horseback soon after dinner the next day. He was not dyspeptic, on his way to Bassett, to see his sister Moss and her husband. For having made up his mind irrevocably that he would pay Mrs. Glegg her loan of £500, it naturally occurred to him that he had a promissory note for £300 lent to his brother-in-law Moss, and if the said brother-in-law could manage to pay in the money within a given time, it would go far to lessen the fallacious air of inconvenience which Mr. Tulliver's spirited step might have worn in the eyes of weak people who require to know precisely how a thing is to be done before they are strongly confident that it will be easy. For Mr. Tulliver was in a position neither new nor striking, but, like other everyday things, sure to have a cumulative effect that will be felt in the long run. He was held to be a much more substantial man than he really was. And as we are all apt to believe what the world believes about us, it was his habit to think of failure and ruin with the same sort of remote pity with which a spare, long-necked man hears that his plethoric short-necked neighbor is stricken with apoplexy. He had been always used to hear pleasant jokes about his advantages as a man who worked his own mill and owned a pretty bit of land, and these jokes naturally kept up his sense that he was a man of considerable substance. They gave a pleasant flavor to his glass on a market day, and if it had not been for the recurrence of half-yearly payments, Mr. Tulliver would really have forgotten that there was a mortgage of £2,000 on his very desirable freehold. That was not altogether his own fault, since one of the 1,000 pounds was his sister's fortune, which he had to pay on her marriage. And a man who has neighbors that will go to law with him is not likely to pay off his mortgages, especially if he enjoys the good opinion of acquaintances who want to borrow £100 on security too lofty to be represented by parchment. Our friend Mr. Tulliver had a good-natured fiber in him, and did not like to give harsh refusals even to his sister, who had not only come into the world in that superfluous way characteristic of sisters, creating a necessity for mortgages, but had quite thrown herself away in marriage, and had crowned her mistakes by having an 8th baby. On this point Mr. Tulliver was conscious of being a little weak. But he apologized to himself by saying that poor Gritty had been a good-looking wench before she married Moss. He would sometimes say this even with a slight tremulousness in his voice. But this morning he was in a mood more becoming a man of business, and in the course of his ride along the Bassett lanes, with their deep ruts, lying so far away from a market town, that the labor of drawing produce and manure was enough to take away the best part of the profits on such poor land as that parish was made of, he got up a due amount of irritation against Moss as a man without capital, who, if Murrain and Blight were abroad, was sure to have his share of them, and who, the more you tried to help him out of the mud, would sink the further in. It would do him good rather than harm now, if he were obliged to raise this £300. It would make him look about him better, and not act so foolishly about his wool this year as he did the last. In fact, Mr. Tulliver had been too easy with his brother-in-law, and because he had let the interest run on for 2 years, Moss was likely enough to think that he should never be troubled about the principal. But Mr. Tulliver was determined not to encourage such shuffling people any longer, and a ride along the Bassett lanes was not likely to enervate a man's resolution by softening his temper. The deep-trodden hoof marks, made in the muddiest days of winter, gave him a shake now and then which suggested a rash, but stimulating snarl at the father of lawyers, who, whether by means of his hoof or otherwise, had doubtless something to do with this state of the roads, and the abundance of foul land and neglected fences, that met his eye, though they made no part of his brother Moss's farm, strongly contributed to his dissatisfaction with that unlucky agriculturist. If this wasn't Moss's fallow, it might have been. Bassett was all alike. It was a beggarly parish, in Mr. Tulliver's opinion, and his opinion was certainly not groundless. Bassett had a poor soil, poor roads, a poor non-resident landlord, a poor non-resident vicar, and rather less than half a curate, also poor. If anyone strongly impressed with the power of the human mind to triumph over circumstances, will contend that the parishioners of Bassett might nevertheless have been a very superior class of people, I have nothing to urge against that abstract proposition. I only know that, in point of fact, the Bassett mind was in strict keeping with its circumstances. The muddy lanes, green or clay, that seemed to the unaccustomed eye, to lead nowhere but into each other, did really lead, with patience, to a distant high road. But there were many feet in Bassett which they led more frequently to a center of dissipation, spoken of formerly as the Arcus O'Granby, but among intimates as Dickinson's. A large low room with a sanded floor, a cold scent of tobacco, modified by undetected beer dregs, Mr. Dickinson leaning against the doorpost with a melancholy pimpled face, looking as irrelevant to the daylight as a last night's guttered candle, all this may not seem a very seductive form of temptation. But the majority of men in Bassett found it fatally alluring when encountered on their road toward 4 o'clock on a wintry afternoon. And if any wife in Bassett wished to indicate that her husband was not a pleasure-seeking man, she could hardly do it more emphatically than by saying that he didn't spend a shilling at Dickinson's from one Whitsuntide to another. Mrs. Moss had said so of her husband more than once, when her brother was in a mood to find fault with him, as he certainly was today. and nothing could be less pacifying to Mr. Tulliver than the behavior of the farmyard gate, which he no sooner attempted to push open with his riding stick than it acted as gates without the upper hinge are known to do, to the peril of shins, whether equine or human. He was about to get down, and lead his horse through the damp dirt of the hollow farmyard, shadowed drearily by the large half-timbered buildings, up to the long line of tumble-down dwelling houses standing on a raised causeway. But the timely appearance of a cowboy saved him that frustration of a plan he had determined on, namely, not to get down from his horse during this visit. If a man means to be hard, let him keep in his saddle, and speak from that height, above the level of pleading eyes, and with the command of a distant horizon. Mrs. Moss heard the sound of the horse's feet, and, when her brother rode up, was already outside the kitchen door, with a half-weary smile on her face, and a black-eyed baby in her arms. Mrs. Moss's face bore a faded resemblance to her brother's. Baby's little fat hand, pressed against her cheek, seemed to show more strikingly that the cheek was faded. "Brother, I'm glad to see you," she said, in an affectionate tone. I didn't look for you today. How do you do?" "Oh, pretty well, Mrs. Moss, pretty well," answered the brother, with cool deliberation, as if it were rather too forward of her to ask that question. She knew at once that her brother was not in a good humor. He never called her Mrs. Moss except when he was angry, and when they were in company. But she thought it was in the order of nature that people who were poorly off should be snubbed. Mrs. Moss did not take her stand on the equality of the human race. She was a patient, prolific, loving-hearted woman. "Your husband isn't in the house, I suppose?" added Mr. Tulliver after a grave pause, during which four children had run out, like chickens whose mother has been suddenly in eclipse behind the hen coop. "No," said Mrs. Moss, "but he's only in the potato field yonders. Georgie, run to the far close in a minute, and tell father your uncle's come. You'll get down, brother, won't you, and take something?" "No, no, I can't get down. I must be going home again directly," said Mr. Tulliver, looking at the distance. "And how's Mrs. Tulliver and the children?" said Mrs. Moss, humbly, not daring to press her invitation. "Oh, pretty well. Tom's going to a new school at midsummer, a deal of expense to me. It's bad work for me, lying out all my money. I wish you'd be so good as let the children come and see their cousin someday. My little uns want to see their cousin Maggie so as never was. And me her godmother, and so fond of her, there's nobody ud make a bigger fuss with her, according to what they've got. And I know she likes to come, for she's a loving child, and how quick and clever she is, to be sure. If Mrs. Moss had been one of the most astute women in the world, instead of being one of the simplest, she could have thought of nothing more likely to propitiate her brother than this praise of Maggie. He seldom found anyone volunteering praise of the little wench. It was usually left entirely to himself to insist on her merits. But Maggie always appeared in the most amiable light at her Aunt Moss's. It was her Alsatia, where she was out of the reach of law. If she upset anything, dirtied her shoes, or tore her frock, these things were matters of course at her Aunt Moss's. In spite of himself, Mr. Tulliver's eyes got milder, and he did not look away from his sister as he said, "Eh, she's fonder o' you than o' the other aunts, I think. She takes after our family. Not a bit of her mother's in her." "Moss says she's just like what I used to be," said Mrs. Moss, "though I was never so quick and fond o' the books. But I think my Lizzie's like her. She's sharp. Come here, Lizzie, my dear, and let your uncle see you. He hardly knows you, you grow so fast." Lizzie, a black-eyed child of 7, looked very shy when her mother drew her forward, for the small Mosses were much in awe of their uncle from Dorlcote Mill. She was inferior enough to Maggie in fire and strength of expression to make the resemblance between the two entirely flattering to Mr. Tulliver's fatherly love. "Eh, they're a bit alike," he said, looking kindly at the little figure in the soiled pinafore. "Tea they both take after our mother. You've got enough old gels, Gritty, he added, in a tone half compassionate, half reproachful. Four of 'em, bless 'em, said Mrs. Moss, with a sigh, stroking Lizzie's hair on each side of her forehead. As many as there's boys. They've got a brother apiece. Ah, but they must turn out and fend for themselves, said Mr. Tulliver, feeling that its severity was relaxing and trying to brace it by throwing out a wholesome hint they mustn't look too hanging on their brothers. No, but I hope their brothers all love the poor things, and remember they came o' one father and mother. The lads all never be the poorer for that, said Mrs. Moss, flashing out with hurried timidity, like a half-smothered fire. Mr. Tulliver gave his horse a little stroke on the flank, then checked it, and said angrily, Stand still with you, much to the astonishment of that innocent animal. And the more there is of 'em, the more they must love one another, Mrs. Moss went on, looking at her children with a didactic purpose. But she turned toward her brother again to say, Not but what I hope your boy all always be good to his sister, though there's but two of 'em, like you and me, brother. The arrow went straight to Mr. Tulliver's heart. He had not a rapid imagination, but the thought of Maggie was very near to him, and he was not long in seeing his relation to his own sister side by side with Tom's relation to Maggie. Would the little wench ever be poorly off, and Tom rather hard upon her? Eh, Gritty, said the miller, with a new softness in his tone. But I've always done what I could for you, he added, as if vindicating himself from a reproach. I'm not denying that, brother, and I'm no ways ungrateful, said poor Mrs. Moss, too fagged by toil and children, to have strength left for any pride. Be but here's the father. What a while you've been, Moss. While, do you call it? Said Mr. Moss, feeling out of breath and injured. I've been running all the way. Won't you light, Mr. Tulliver? Well, I'll just get down and have a bit o' talk with you in the garden, said Mr. Tulliver, thinking that he should be more likely to show a due spirit of resolve if his sister were not present. He got down and passed with Mr. Moss into the garden toward an old yew tree arbor, while his sister stood tapping her baby on the back and looking wistfully after them. Their entrance into the yew tree arbor surprised several fowls that were recreating themselves by scratching deep holes in the moldy ground, and at once took flight with much pother and cackling. Mr. Tulliver sat down on the bench, and tapping the ground curiously here and there with his stick, as if he suspected some hollowness, opened the conversation by observing, with something like a snarl in his tone, Why, you've got wheat again in that corner close, I see, and never a bit o' dressing on it. You'll do no good with it this year. Mr. Moss, who, when he married Miss Tulliver, had been regarded as the buck of Basset, now wore a beard nearly a week old, and had the depressed unexpectant air of a machine horse. He answered in a patient, grumbling tone, Why, poor farmers like me must do as they can. They must leave it to them as have got money to play with, to put half as much into the ground as they mean to get out of it. I don't know who should have money to play with, if it isn't them as can borrow money without paying interest, said Mr. Tulliver, who wished to get into a slight quarrel. It was the most natural and easy introduction to calling in money. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.